So you're doing like this unofficial tour of Cascadia.
Yeah, we've done a transit, I call it, of Cascadia, starting in southern Alberta and ending up in the, I guess it's the southwest, northwest corner of Cascadia. No, not northwest.
Northwest U.S., but...
Yeah, yeah. We think of it as the southwest in Canada.
Right,
I know. Northwest here, so...
I know.
Yeah.
That's why we don't like to call, it the Pacific Northwest, because that implies that it's U.S.-centric.
And really, that would be Alaska, the Pacific Northwest.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, tell us about... And this is excerpted in Make It True, the poetry from Cascadia. So, tell us about Half-Life.
Right. Well, just Half-Life is... I guess it's a successor poem to Versions of North, and it's just continuing to work in the serial poem tradition, the long poem, and where I construct these long poem-like things out of whatever's been going through my head for the last year or so.
And we were talking up there, and I guess we've got Seafair happening here, so we've got planes and all kinds of things happening, but... Barry McKinnon was the guy who kind of opened you up to the possibilities of seriality. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I was just looking, I was kind of stuck. I had been working on in the lyric tradition as long as I could, and I just felt I wasn't moving forward with my poetics. And so I was looking for a model, and a model that would also fit into the kind of life that I was living up north and integrating full-time work into one's life. And the way there would be with this long poem, there would be long periods of fallow and collection and harvesting, and then finally usually in the summers there would be some sort of composition process that would occur, and it would all fit into the life.
The summers, because you're not
teaching
papers.
Yeah, I'm not teaching. I'm not soaking my head in the miasma of student writing for long hours every day.
Well, fire away.
Okay, well, I'll see how far I get into this. This is Half-Life, as I said, a successor poem to Versions of North. It begins with two epigraphs, the first from Ralph Waldo Emerson. When a man has got to a certain point in his career of truth, he becomes conscious forevermore that he must take himself for better for worse as his portion, that what he can get out of his plot of ground by the sweat of his brow is his meat. And then to counter the lofty sentiments of Mr. Emerson, we have a quote from Gabriel Brunt. Every man is capable of showing his contempt for the cruelty and stupidity of the universe by making his own life a poem of incoherence and absurdity. So between these two poles, I suppose, is where I live. And, I like to think that my, I don't need to make a statement of poetics, because my poetics is right there in the work itself. That's certainly what the opening of the poem speaks to, and I'll stop annotating it and read it. I have nothing to say, and I am saying it, in a kind of field poetry. From a position of openness to surrounding context, enveloped by a fine network of half-expressed thoughts and feelings, an atmosphere of such suavity, difficult to resist, almost without restraint, he arrives unexpected and possesses a bare wintry landscape, dotted with plowmen, plodding interminably behind scrawny oxen. The permanent condition of manufactured man, constituted of the sordid, its diabolical subtlety, caught up forever in burning and immortal Byzantine jaws of death, scattered along stations at the long end of the spectrum, things are always going wrong. Naive voluntarism obscures operation of dark forces. Continuously firing gorgeousness upon him, she sprawled him down without even a smile, hacked his heart. Later, weeping on top of the remains of her house, bemoans obstacles to intimacy. Helen, where necessity and beauty converge in the playpen of erotic devotion, crisis heterotopias of deviation begin to function at full capacity. Writing in an obsolete medium of witness and documentation, a field of action, exhibiting aggression to an audience, concealing amidst its reflection of economic and class contradictions, deconstructive death rays, impelled by force grandiose, selfish and cold throughout those dismal days when the dead return to inhabit their former houses, needing to express their tendency to view experience through a lens of literary utility. Walking through streets filled with ghosts of early boy selves, industrious, affable, having brain on fire, everything leads to whatever follows. Bernoulli's encyclopedia of imaginary diseases, including a disdain for humanity as practice, an Olympian desire for perfection over power, creating bridges between radical formalism and a vaudevillian social platform. A strange state of mind, compounded of shock, unnatural calm, and grief sharpened into anguish by the complete wreck of earthly good. Party of animals, animals partying, amidst hyperbolic self-imagining, repudiates all notions of authorization, emptiness with a few things arising in it. Glorification of energetic stupidity, a methodical tool designed to subvert expectations of bourgeois readers suspended in a doubt-like world. There is no escape from heaven, that large brothel called Aquitaine, its hatred of everything that doesn't relate to literature, the proper setting for epic-scale brain warfare among codependent and entangled sadomasochistic poets. Perpetual institutionality of avant-garde practice, the mania for phrases, drying up the heart. And then this part begins with a epigraph, a quote from John Cage. If anyone is sleepy, let him go to sleep. That would be a general order during poetry readings. Write as short as you can in order of what matters, as if your parents are dead. Your loneliness is a complex group dynamic to keep the mind alert but empty. Practice, a syncretic poetics of ingenuity and invention, collage and palimpsest, where music invades the sentence at the vulvic gateway to our chaos, dreams leak and the dead return, but only if you love grim deeds and moral panic, that aridity required for the production of genius, self-involved and unable to draw joy from the world, its pitch, timbre, loudness, duration, glorious penetralium locating us as part of an intensity, not an instant lost, doing what must be done. Women edge away from the smell of hopelessness, the fraudulent imposition of eros over ananke, minor, deceptive, and extended detourment, normal, merited, marital hatred. Devote one's life to beating one's head against that wall, collecting, hoarding, and archiving laws and people, ambitionless setting oneself up on verge of room, a maggot on the corpse of its revisionist masters. Narcissistic aversion to seeing oneself as permanently ill, divination algebra connects holographic sense to useless primordial reality of soul. Prepare for the next dumb blow, barest inkling of joyful wisdom always, overwhelmed by cheap teenage nihilism. I'm going to stop there while my tongue is still with me.
I understand. It's tough work.
Well, it was excerpts in the book, so I ran it together, and so I did that with the book too in readings with the versions, because it is such a long work and it's versions, and you can bring parts together that aren't originally together and they still work in a kind of way, and mm-hmm. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Writing in an obsolete medium of witness and documentation. I'm not asking you to explain that, but
well, this just speaks out of my profound ambivalence about writing as a venture, period.
Because?
Because it, you know, in my dark moments, it seems to me irrelevant.
Who's paying attention why does this matter?
Yeah, it's just irrelevant. I tell my students, you know, why aren't you apprenticing as a barrel maker? You know, to apprentice as a poet in the 21st century seems wildly irrelevant to what's going on in the world. And yet it's something that a lot of us are compelled to do.
Yeah. Are chosen to do.
are chosen to do. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, it's something, you know, you write because you have to, not because it's something you get up and make a decision to do. You decide to every day. You do because you have to. Something in you drives it, I suppose.
You've been at Fort St. John for 20 years.
Yes. Yeah.
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 And
so I feel like I've done my time. I've done my sentence in a way. You know, that's one of the inversions of the North. One of the conceits that runs through it is of a kind of, you know, a gulag situation. And that, you know, I was sentenced to 20 years of boredom, you know, as Leonard Cohen says, for trying to change the system from within. Uh-huh. You know, the arrogance of all of us who think we can go into these huge institutions and teach and administer and do these things and we can make a difference in the world. And, you know, maybe we do. I don't know. Maybe we don't. It's hard to tell from your position in this moment of time.
But there's something about the isolation. I mean, poets are always isolated, period. But something about that isolation that could have proven useful to you, do you think?
Yes and no.
You're
yes
wincing.
And no. Yes and no. I mean, you really miss a community of like-minded people. So that would be the strong connection to Prince George, you know, where's a place where, you know, in many ways would be my poetry home, you know, more so than Calgary or Vancouver, places where I also spent significant amounts of time and helped to form my literary consciousness. But, I mean, Prince George has just been a place that's been there for me, to do my work and to have a small audience and a small community to, you know, to talk to regularly and write for, you know, the idea that people are kind of actually looking forward to something by you is pretty compelling.
You do this Cascadia tour, and this feels a lot like where you live.
Yeah, very much. Well, this feels like a lot of places that I have lived in BC, like, the Portland, Seattle seems a lot like Vancouver, and when I'm off in the side streets and the houses and the patterns of settlement, and you have done a better job of hiding the First Nations people, I've noticed, that they've been pretty much taken out of the picture.
Yeah, they have. You see some folks downtown, and there's actually a lady in the market who grew up here, but of Haida nature,
yeah.
And I bought some cards from her today.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know where to look, but yes, it's less here, and I think even less so in Portland. So what is it about Cascadia culture? What sets this bioregion apart? You're actually not living in the bioregion proper, but you're Vernon and Kamloops, that's essentially where you're from,
yeah.
And that's certainly in it. So what is it about this culture that makes it different from other places around the world?
Well, it's you know, I guess it's the western edge of the continent, and it was the last place, you know, for a lot of people to, you know, move into, the last place for the Europeans to settle. And I don't know, it's just got that Pacific thing going on, you know, the moderating influence of the Pacific Ocean once you get on this side of the mountains, you know, takes that edge off. You know, like when Pound was talking about England back in, you know, 1914, and how about, you know, the Gulf Stream creates this kind of placidity in the English. Well, I think the same thing here. There's something about that Pineapple Express in the winter, the mild temperatures, the greenery, the integration of nature into, you know, most people's idea of life. You know, even people in the cities are always looking to get out into the country, and there's a whole bunch of things. And then there's the economic things. I mean, you know, it's the same logging trucks driving on the same dusty rides, drives north and south. And there's the, you know, the orchards and the agriculture and the seafood and that sort of thing that we've been enjoying on our trip here, of course, because we're on the wrong side of the mountains. We're on that harsh Calvinistic side of the mountains, where it's rodeo culture and Texlahoma, and you're either with us or against us. There's much less tolerance than there is on this side of the mountains.
Texlahoma is also a project of yours.
Yeah, yeah. I have a long poem about, you know, travels in Texlahoma, and just it's kind of my long gonzo poem, and people who know me really like it and say it's, you know, among my most accessible works, but it's one that I haven't released for various, you know, private reasons.
We'll just leave it at that.
Fine.
Thanks for coming to say hi.
Yeah, I'm glad I did, Paul. It's really good to meet you.
My pleasure.
Yeah.